In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, University of Pennsylvania Cary Law School professor Kermit Roosevelt and Republican attorney James Bopp Jr. debate using the 14th Amendment to disqualify former President Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot. Then, Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. discusses his White House bid, issues he's running on, and some of his controversial statements. Plus, a discussion about the new COVID-19 vaccine that was approved by the FDA and CDC this week with Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Now, University of Pennsylvania Cary Law School Professor Kermit Roosevelt and Republican Attorney James Bopp Jr. discuss efforts to disqualify former President Trump from running for president.
The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, Section 3 of that amendment is really what we're going to be focusing on this morning. Let me just read it for viewers to let them know what it says. It bars from public office anyone who took, quote, an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution of the United States, and then, quote, engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States unless Congress removes such disability by a two-thirds vote. Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution. Professor Roosevelt, give us a historical context here first of when the 14th Amendment was ratified and why it came into being.
The 14th Amendment is ratified in 1868, so it's a post-Civil War measure. And basically what this section is responding to is the concern that the Reconstruction Congress had that former Confederate states would be sending disloyal people to represent them in the House of Representatives and the Senate. So this is a provision that disqualifies not anyone who joined the Confederacy, but a narrower set, people who took an oath to support the Constitution and then participated in the rebellion.
Mr. Bopp, same sort of question of who this was meant for. And do you think this section, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, was meant to outlive Confederate veterans?
Yes, I think it was, because its effect was both retrospective, so that it affected people involved in the Civil War against the United States, and then secondly, it is prospective, rebellions or insurrections that people would be disqualified if, prior to engaging in an insurrection, they had taken an oath to the Constitution of the United States.
And Mr. Bopp, on the wording of this, shall have engaged in insurrection, why that wording? Why not shall have been convicted of insurrection as defined by U.S. code or something like that? Is the wording here, why is it imprecise, some might say?
Well, I don't think it's imprecise. It's just broad. Yes, it does not require a criminal conviction. And there, of course, is a criminal federal statute that makes it a felony to engage in insurrection. But they chose to provide that without a conviction. But if you have done this and it can be determined pursuant to proper legal process, because every state has a mechanism by which you get on the ballot, you file your candidacy, and then challenges to your candidacy can be mounted. So if there's a proper state procedure to challenge your candidacy, for instance, then that's available, but you still have to prove it. There still has to be due process and proof that you actually, quote, engaged in insurrection, end quote.
And Professor Roosevelt, that same sort of question here on the process here, and then whose job is it to invoke the provisions of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? Is it secretaries of state? Is it members of Congress? What has history told us?
Well, so it's a little bit unclear. I mean, I agree with everything that Mr. Bopp said there. Generally speaking, the Constitution doesn't prescribe specific procedures. So, you know, if you want to convict someone of treason, it does say you need two witnesses or confession in open court. But generally speaking, the Constitution gives you a right or it sets out a rule, and that's going to be enforced by whatever legal procedures are in place. Now, with the specific application of this provision to members of Congress, which is what people were thinking about most at the time, it's pretty clear how that's going to happen, because the Constitution also says the houses of Congress shall be the judge of the qualifications of their members. So there you can see pretty easily how that works. Southern representatives might present their credentials and the House will refuse to seat them because they'll say, we've decided you took an oath to support the Constitution and then you participated in the insurrection. Now, if you apply this to the president, and there's some dispute about whether it does apply to the president, but then it looks much to me like any other qualification for becoming president. So natural born citizen, 35 years of age, how do those get enforced? You don't need a conviction. You do need some sort of proof. There's going to be some kind of proceeding, but probably it will be done by whoever normally enforces ballot qualifications, which usually I think would be the Secretary of State of the states.
So cutting right to it, what do you think of the efforts to apply this to Donald Trump in 2024?
Well, I think there's a very strong case constitutionally. So I think there are a bunch of different questions that we need to separate here. One is just sort of as a matter of fact, did he do things that bring him within the scope of this constitutional provision? And I think the answer to that is yes. We can talk about it more, but I think yes. Then there's a question, how will this be enforced? You know, who can sue to have him excluded? Probably not just anyone. What is the standard of proof that's going to be used in the proceeding that eventually comes? I think probably preponderance of the evidence, but that's not clear. And then the last question, which in some ways is maybe the most important, would be, is this a good idea? Is this good for our democracy? What's going to happen if a court says he's not eligible and someone who has such massive support is simply excluded from the election? We're in untested waters, I think.
Mr. Bob, on those questions, is this a good idea and should it apply to Donald Trump?
Well, it's, of course, inherently anti-democratic. So we have to look through that lens. And because if you support democracy, you don't want people willy-nilly to be thrown off the ballot. So you would want to look at this carefully scrutinize whether a person actually did engage in insurrection. And rather than take a very broad view, which is some recent law review articles have done, a very broad view of this, which would frankly mean, if all of its parts were accepted, that someone who went to the House chamber in the gallery and protested climate change and resulted in a delay of the chamber, that person would have engaged in insurrection against the United States. And so that's ridiculously broad. So we need to really attend to what it meant at the time. And that raised, I think, conclusively, that there is a pathetically weak case against Trump that should never be pursued. The other point about it being a good idea is we need to play this out in our mind, at least. If you had 50 states each deciding through their own state procedures, sometimes the Secretary of State, sometimes the Election Board, whatever, sometimes courts, deciding in for each state whether Trump is qualified to get on the ballot. Do you have any idea the chaos and destruction of our electoral system that would result in? What would happen if he is taken off the ballot by a process in Pennsylvania 6 days before the primary, and then he's removed from the ballot and he loses the ballot and is not on the general election ballot? I mean, how are we going to fix that? What happens if in Wisconsin they take him off a week before the general election, and he loses the general election? And the most extreme enforcement of this has been suggested, that any public official that has a responsibility to determine the qualifications of a candidate is required to act as if Trump is a disqualified candidate. Does that apply to a precinct worker that is counting ballots in a particular precinct and could decide, well, no, he's not qualified to be on the ballot, and so we're not going to count, or at least I'm not going to count, those votes. I litigated Bush v. Gore, and that was involved two counties and one state, and it was extremely difficult in the very compressed time frame to get that case resolved. Can you imagine 30, 40 states where the results are all over the place as far as people deciding this one critical question and how our system would be able to respond? I don't think it can. And it would be not just a meltdown, but it would be a delegitimizing of our election system in a way that has never happened in the past.
That was Republican Attorney James Bopp Jr. and Professor Kermit Roosevelt from the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Next, Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. discusses his candidacy, issues he's running on, and his battle with the Democratic National Committee over the nominating process.
Mr. Kennedy, you launched your campaign in April. What have you learned since then, not only about those you're trying to reach or how they're responding to you?
I think that there's a lot of appetite for an alternative right now. We're getting enormous crowds in South Carolina, in New Hampshire and other states. I talked to crowds yesterday. I think we had almost 750 people the day before yesterday at a very remote farm in New Hampshire, and we had about 650 in Winthrop College the day before. The crowds we're getting are comparable to what Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama were getting during the late primary season. So we're very happy, and you know, our polling shows us, our internal polling shows us doing very, very well in those states.
When it comes then to when you talk to those people, if you had to boil it down, what's the message you're selling to them? What are you telling them? Do you think that's getting the appeal?
You know, I would describe myself as a progressive. I'm skeptical about the war. I'm very critical about the way that Ukraine war has been handled, and that issue has tremendous resonance now with the American people. More and more people are seeing the drain it's putting on our economy. More and more people see the mistakes that the Biden administration has made in a war that should never have happened. And you know, my major focus is what's happening to the American middle class. I'm running against two presidents who are both running, both served a term in the White House, a four-year term, and they're telling the American public that they're running based upon the prosperity that they brought to this country. But I'm sitting at people's kitchen tables, I'm talking to big crowds, and many people, nobody is talking about prosperity. They're talking about a deterioration, a disintegration of the middle class, the working poor in this country, the economic disintegration. This year, we had the highest jump in poverty in American history. And they are, you know, and also the mental health deterioration, the physical health deterioration that they're seeing all around us. The inability of kids to purchase houses now, as these giant corporations, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, try to monopolize single-family homes in this country. And we're looking at a colonial model now, a feudal model, rather than the classic American capitalism. And people are feeling it. People are living with a tremendous amount of anxiety as they live from paycheck to paycheck. 57% of the people in this country cannot put their hands on $1,000 if they have an emergency in their family. And for those families, they see the engine light come on in their car, and it's like the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, they don't know how they're going to pay the mechanic. They start thinking about not being able to get to work, about losing their job, losing a home that they're barely hanging on to. The income, Pedro, the average income in this country is now $5,000 less than the cost of basic needs of food, transportation, and housing. And people are putting that $5,000 deficit that they're experiencing every year on their credit cards. Mm. We have the highest level of credit card debt in history, $1 trillion. We just passed that milestone. And those card companies are charging them 22% interest. If the mafia did that, they would go to jail for loan sharking. But for these companies, it's business as usual.
So, Mr. Kennedy, if that's the case economically, if that's the case you're making, well, how does a Kennedy administration reverse those trends? Specifically, what are your plans economically that would do that?
Well, you know, we have a very comprehensive economic plan that looks at each of these issues. I mean, I'll start with housing because the feedback that I'm getting from Americans is that is the biggest issue, or one of the biggest issues. And you know, we have these three giant companies that are trying to buy up all the single-family homes in this country, and it's driven the cost of housing from $200,000. The average home in this country 2 years ago cost $215,000. Today it's $400,000. And the interest rates have gone from 3% to 7%. Oh, it's completely out of reach. The fulcrum of the American dream, that if you work hard, if you play by the rules, that you'll be able to afford a house, that you will be able to raise a family, that you can get a summer vacation and put money aside for your retirement, that on a single job. That was the American dream. That was the American promise. And that promise is now evaporated. Americans are struggling just to pay their bills. And one of the things that I'm going to do to address that issue is, number one, I'm going to change the tax code to make it less profitable for these giant companies to buy up all our single-family homes. Our kids, when they go out to buy a home, are competing with BlackRock, which is paying interest rates that are 30% below the richest people in our country. And these companies are trying to buy up all our homes. We are on track now that 60% of the single-family homes in our country will be owned by corporations within 6 years. This is a feudal model and a colonial model. And one of the other things I'm going to do is I'm going to create a housing boom in this country and allow Americans to compete with BlackRock. And I'm going to do that by creating a class of single-family home mortgages at 3%. You know, if you have a rich uncle who will co-sign your mortgage, you can get a much better rate because the bank is basing your interest rates not on your lousy credit score, but on your rich uncle's high credit rating. So I'm going to give everybody a rich uncle, which is Uncle Sam. And I'm going to create a class of mortgages at 3% for single-family home buyers who will live in that community and work in that community. I'm going to give the first $500,000 to teachers, our most important profession, a neglected and beleaguered profession,
okay,
so that they can live in the communities where their children are. I'm going to finance that by selling treasury bills at 3% tax-free. So this is not going to add to the deficit. And I'm going to allow Americans to now compete against these giant corporations that are buying up all of our housing stock. And that will bring the average price of a mortgage down to $1,000 a month, which is affordable for most Americans.
Mr. Kennedy, you have an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal this morning. I'll just show folks the headline at home. It just says the Democratic Party rigs the primaries. What's the focus of the piece?
Well, the Democratic Party is basically doing the same thing to me that they did to Bernie Sanders last time, but worse. They, in fact, are adopting rules that will disenfranchise the citizens of states like Iowa and New Hampshire I voted against President Biden last time. So because I've campaigned in Iowa and New Hampshire, I will not be allowed to win any delegates from those states under these DNC rules. Not only that, but the DNC is now adopting a rule that will disenfranchise Georgia voters so that any candidate who steps into New Hampshire, which is me, will not be able to win any delegates from Georgia. So no matter how big my vote plurality is in Georgia, I will not be able to win any of those delegates. And that really is existential, because Georgia has 164 delegates, a very, very large state. And it's paradoxical as well, because the Democratic Party, and my family in particular, since the 1960s, has been fighting for voting rights for the people of Georgia. And it is ironic at this point that the Democratic Party is now leading the battle to virtually effectively disenfranchise every Georgia voter, so that their votes will not count in the Democratic primary. And there are a lot of other mechanisms that the DNC has put in place, including the superdelegates, this new class of superdelegates called PLEOs. They're party leaders and other elected officials, and they're all controlled by the party, and they're there to ensure that whoever wins, if a progressive candidate like myself wins the Democratic nomination, we will not be able to actually get the nomination, even if we win the convention, if we win the primary. So it's not Pedro, it's not very democratic. we're living at a time right now when a lot of people are, Americans are disillusioned with the system that we have, not only the economic system, which they know is rigged against them, but also the political system, which many Americans believe is rigged. And, we need to conduct elections in this country, both political parties, that are templates, that are role models for the rest of the world, that show the world that we are the exemplary democracy. That's not, we shouldn't be like the Soviet Union, where the party came in, picked the candidate at the outset. They claimed they were a democracy. The Communist Party would come in, pick the candidate, and say, this is the only candidate you can vote for. Well, the Democratic Party is essentially doing the exact same thing in this election. It's not a It's not a good exemplar for democracy.
That was Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Next, a discussion about the new COVID-19 vaccine boosters that were approved earlier this week by the FDA and CDC.
Joining us this morning is Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Doctor, let's begin with the new booster that was announced by the FDA and the CDC for COVID-19. What should Americans know about this?
Well, thanks, Greta. Thank you very much for having me with you this morning. Well, I think Americans should know that COVID is still with us, but that we have much better tools that we have developed over the last 2.5 years. We know a lot more about the character and the way the virus functions, and we have better vaccines, and we have better therapeutics, and we've learned a lot about how to protect ourselves and treat ourselves should you get exposed to the virus.
If you get exposed today, what is the virus like, and is the booster needed?
I believe the booster is absolutely needed. It's an updated vaccine. And what happens for most people, we now know that either you've had some degree of protection because you've been vaccinated, or you were exposed to the virus and you were infected. So in that environment, the vast majority of Americans do have some degree of protection, but it wanes over time. And that means that this updated vaccine is important to maintain the high level of protection that keeps you from getting really sick.
Who needs it?
Everyone over the age of 6 needs it. That's what's recommended, that everyone who's over the age of 6 and over should get this updated vaccine.
What do we know about COVID-19? You touched on that, but you know, what are some specifics that people should know about what we've learned over the past 2.5 years about this virus?
We know that this virus mutates frequently, likes to change. But at least so far, when it has changed, it for the worse, it gets a little bit more infectious, meaning that it becomes easier to pass from one person to another. We know that it is easy to pass from one person to another, even if you don't have symptoms, which makes it very difficult, you know, to detect when you've, you know, from one person to another when someone gets infected. We know that if you're older or you have a lot of immune compromise, chronic diseases, heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, that you're much more likely to get really sick if you get exposed and infected from this virus. And we know that we can protect ourselves. And by the way, we know this is true for adults and for children. And so that even though children traditionally don't get as sick as adults, we do have children that get very sick, and we do have children that still die from this disease.
What do we know about how long our immunity lasts?
We know that somewhere around 3 to 4 months after you get your vaccination, it begins to wane some. And the waning is in such a way that you can still get infected. And in addition, if you do get infected, at least so far, most people who've been fully vaccinated don't get really sick, but, you know, to the point that people die. But we still are seeing deaths. And we're now seeing, of course, deaths in people who've been vaccinated, but that's because their immune status has waned.
And how concerned are you, if at all, about vaccine fatigue? It seems like you would be concerned about that, given what you've said.
I'm very concerned about vaccine fatigue. You know, all of us want to be over this. But look, we still need to be vigilant. This is not a minor cold. This disease can still cause significant disease. And more importantly, that it creates a chronic disease state in a number of people called long COVID. And that's the chronic joint aches, brain fog, sometimes persistent weakness, just a range of symptoms that we're still trying to really get our hands around exactly all the things that it does. But we know that this virus can affect almost every single organ system. And this long COVID phenomena is in addition to the acute, you know, disease that we see when people get infected.
That was Dr. Georges Benjamin, Executive Director of the American Public Health Association. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.